A missile has landed in Poland, killing two people. Ukraine accuses Russia, whilst Moscow denies any involvement. The US and NATO are investigating. Can the risk of a spillover from the war in Ukraine be contained? This is Inside Story. Hello there and welcome to the programme. I'm Laura Kyle. A missile strike in Poland has raised fears the war in Ukraine could spill over into neighbouring countries, and that has the potential to pull the Western military alliance NATO directly into the conflict. The strike killed two people in a Polish village near the Ukrainian border. Now, Ukraine is blaming Russia, but Moscow says it had nothing to do with it. Poland identifies the missile as Russian-made, but both Russia and Ukraine have this weapon in their arsenals. Early investigations suggest it may have been fired by Ukrainian forces to intercept an incoming Russian missile. Poland's president says there is no evidence to suggest the attack was deliberate.
It was probably an S-300 rocket made in the Soviet Union, an old rocket, and there is no evidence that it was launched by the Russian side. It is highly probable that it was fired by Ukrainian anti-aircraft defense and unfortunately fell on our territory.
Well, Poland is a member of NATO, which held an emergency meeting in Brussels. Its Secretary General says Russia is ultimately to blame.
Our preliminary analysis suggests that the incident was likely caused by a Ukrainian air defense missile fired to defend Ukrainian territory against Russian cruise missile attacks. But let me be clear. This is not Ukraine's fault. Russia bears ultimate responsibility as it continues its illegal war against Ukraine.
Well, back in June, the US announced it would open a permanent military base in Poland to boost NATO's defences in countries bordering Ukraine. The alliance has added four new combat units in Slovakia, Romania, Bulgaria and Hungary. Just this week, Germany announced it will establish a maintenance hub in Slovakia to service and repair weapons it has delivered to Ukraine. And since September, the Slovak airspace is being protected by the Czech and Polish air forces. That's after the country decided to phase out the use of its Soviet-era MiG-29 fighters. Moldova remains relatively neutral. It closed its airspace to the world when the invasion began and announced a state of emergency. Well, now let's bring in our guests. And in Belfast, we have Alexander Titov, a lecturer in modern European history at Queen's University Belfast and a specialist on Russia. In Singapore, Samir Puri, a visiting lecturer in war studies at King's College London and author of the book Russia's Road to War with Ukraine. And in Washington, Robert Hunter, a former US ambassador to NATO under President Bill Clinton. A very warm welcome to all of you. Robert, if I could start with you. This is a day that many predicted would come, a spillover of Russia's war into NATO territory. How have you rated the response?
Well, I'm not so sure it really is a spillover of the war. That implies something quite major. If it was a Ukrainian missile that went off course, then it's actually a rather minor matter. The response here has been very interesting. The president does not want to see escalation. If at all possible. He wants Russia to back off. He wants to support Mr. Zelensky and what he's doing in Ukraine. But for once, the administration has kept its message very tightly controlled and has not gotten ahead of the facts. This is a good thing because more than the actual matter that took place on Polish territory is the symbolism it has and the heightened anxiety within various NATO countries, mostly along the frontier with Ukraine, that there might be a wider war. So it's the psychological impact which is far more important than the incident itself.
Alexander, it does seem that Russia has appreciated the calm response from the US. Might one go so far to say this has gone some way to improving trust between the two sides?
No, of course not. The fact that Americans, as was said, kind of had a careful message, and they released reasonably soon their own assessments, which, of course, they see everything what happens and where enemy missiles are flying from and so forth in this area, suggested that they don't want escalation. But at the same time, the message is also coming very clear that Russia is bearing ultimate responsibility. This is kind of a message which has been kind of sent out by all the NATO countries, and they basically, they, at this point in time, at least, they are quite happy the way things are going, in a sense that they're happy to the level of support for Ukraine and how Ukraine is doing against Russia so far. So at the moment, there's no reason for escalation, but at the same time, this incident shows that you cannot always control escalation in these areas, in these circumstances. And of course, this is just a reminder of that it is actually can spiral out of control quite easily between NATO and Russia, as well as between Russia and Ukraine.
Robert, how close do you think it was to spiraling out of control?
I don't think at all. Once people had the slightest chance of assessment, most of the other allies don't want to be engaged in this, almost all of them. And the ones, so-called front line, are just fearing for their future. But given the uncertainties, various chancelleries within NATO began to become more anxious, and it started looking to their own security arrangements. What this does illustrate, I think, is that NATO, the West, et cetera, has been inadequate in helping Ukraine deal with incoming missiles, cruise missiles, drones, et cetera, which are now obviously designed to capitalize on historically what was called General Winter, to try to block out Ukraine during a very, very difficult winter, and also to send a message to West European countries that their own heat and light this winter could be directly or indirectly at risk. So what is not needed is German airplanes. What is needed is high-quality anti-missile defenses, which the United States has and should be supplying.
Mm, okay, we'll come back to that point in just a moment. First of all, Samir, although most leaders seem to agree that this missile was a misfire from Ukraine, Ukraine is still not accepting that. Why not?
It's about the credibility of their air defense systems. And this is building on the point that Robert made. This is one of the most important defensive features of Ukraine's sort of standing in the war. And I think it's worth just reminding ourselves that the area around the Polish border has been targeted by the Russians and their long distance missile strikes in the past. One strike in particular came to mind when I was seeing the news of this blast in Poland. That was on the 13th of March in a place called Yavoriv, which is just to the west of Lviv. It's in Ukraine, but not too far from the Polish border. The Russians said that they struck a hub for Western military assistance being sent from NATO, from Poland, into Western Ukraine to be dispersed in the war zone. So, you know, obviously this is a very well-protected part of Ukraine, given its importance as a hub. And I think the Ukrainians will be really keen to signal to all around that this is not something that they can fail to defend.
Ukraine is saying it wants immediate access to the impact site, that it wants to be involved in the investigation. Just give us an idea, if you can, what that investigation is going to look like and what more it's going to tell us.
I mean, seeing the debris at the sort of source, obviously there'll be fragmentation if it survived the blast. Normally there's some sort of fragmentation that survives a blast. That might allow for a definitive conclusion to be drawn as to, you know, whose missile it was. I suppose if the Ukrainians privately want to work out what had happened, if it was indeed one of their air defence missiles, they may actually also be wondering what mistake was made, or whether the missile system was triggered by accident. Or perhaps what we're not hearing is that there is actually a response to an active Russian strike or a threat of a Russian strike. And I think there's a picture to be put together by the Ukrainians.
Mm. Well, you mentioned before that the blame, Alexander, does still sit very squarely with Russia. Most leaders still saying this is Russia's responsibility for starting the war in the first place. Do you think that's acceptable in any way to Russia?
Well, I think they are gone beyond. I mean, when the whole war started, that was already a sign that they don't care about what the West thinks, right? So it's a matter of who gets whom on the battleground. So that's, we moved to that stage. So there's no kind of trust. There's no trying to win hearts and minds and so forth on either side. But with this, I think the Kremlin will be kind of mildly happy that, you know, the first strike, which actually killed two members. Polish citizens came from Ukraine rather than from Russia. Ukraine's reaction would be kind of quite interesting. As you said, they're still insisting that it was Russian missile. And the Secretary of the Security Council, Danilov, just said that they have proof that it was Russia, even though, you know, I think it's pretty clear. I mean, the Pentagon wouldn't be saying if they had any doubt that it was Ukrainian missiles, if they had any doubt about it. So I think Ukraine has to play it really carefully, because basically, the assumption is, let's just blame the Russia and move on from this. And the fact that Ukraine is not moving on and still insisting on the kind of Russian, that it was Russian missile, might kind of undermine its kind of standing in the long term. But so they have to be careful how they play it.
I mean, Russia also has to be careful, though, doesn't it? We've had at least one rather unhelpful comment from the Kremlin, from the former president, Dmitry Medvedev, who said earlier today that the explosion shows that the West is moving closer to another world war. That's pretty inflammatory.
Well, I mean, that's Medvedev has can develop this renommee for being this very vocal hawk on his Telegram channel since the war started. The key to Russia, of course, is that to keep out NATO as much as possible from Ukraine, including from supplies of weapons, if it can, and so forth. So, yeah, that rhetoric goes some ways to reminding what's at stake. But I think overall, that the accident happened, that was a spillover from the war, so to say, but it was Ukrainian responsible, would be kind of beneficial for Russia, the way they see it, that it's actually kind of Ukraine's fault, and Ukraine can be trusted, so, and so forth.
Robert, there really is no appetite at all from NATO countries, is there, to escalate this war, to enter it against Russia?
Well, that's absolutely true. In fact, the facts of the missile itself are almost immaterial. It's what individual countries and their leaders make of it. Mm. There's an old cynical line in American statecraft, no good crisis should go to waste. Now, for the Ukrainians, however this happened, this helps them illustrate to the West that unless there is greater help for Ukraine, in particular in its air defenses or its defenses against missiles, this kind of thing can happen, and it might get out of control. So the Ukrainians have been, I think, very smart from their perspective to emphasize the escalatory possibilities. Incidentally, as for Mr. Medvedev's comments, I put those more or less in the same category of the saber rattling by Mr. Putin over nuclear weapons. The use of nuclear weapons in this conflict is an absolute absurdity, in the sense that it would be a miscalculation of the greatest order in world history. So the question is, what you have to do now, stern messages to Moscow overall about trying to bring the war to an end, and also stepping up the supply of the high-quality anti-missile capacity to Ukraine.
So, Samir, should we expect the Ukrainians to increase their call for more of such weapon system, high-quality anti-missile systems?
Absolutely. And actually, it's been one of Zelensky's top talking points, is focusing quite specifically on this issue of air defence systems, clearly because Ukrainian cities that are nowhere near the ground war, cities like Lviv, Odessa, even Kiev now, are still being struck intermittently by these Russian long-range weapons, a variety of Russian weapons, in fact. cruise missiles all the way to these so-called kamikaze drones supplied by the Iranians. So there is a clear defensive need. I would say that with that comes the obvious hazard that you're packing in into these cities, into these areas, lots of air defense systems, some of which may be from different countries, because some may come from the USA, some may come from sort of these old sort of Russian-style S-300, S-400 systems. And so there's a huge need as well for the Ukrainians to maintain their situational awareness and make sure that they're not, you know, firing these things by accident, because that can happen. And what goes up must come down. And I think that's one of the lessons, the obvious lessons from this particular sort of tragedy in Poland.
And that's an interesting point, Samir, because Russia did actually say today that Tuesday's strikes on the residential areas of Kyiv were actually Ukraine anti-aircraft missiles, again, misfiring. Do you think there was any truth in that, or are they leaping on today's misfire to excuse all the other missile strikes from yesterday?
I think, Laura, you're touching on a really critical point, which is the sort of counterclaims and the claims of, misattribution. Russians are, of course, past masters at misattributing things on purpose. And it's interesting with this, the blast in Poland. There was almost a sense that the Russian foreign minister is trying to portray this as a Ukrainian false flag operation to draw the Poles in, I guess, draw NATO in. So I think whilst we have to take these things very skeptically in terms of how the Russians frame what's happening, that information war, that messaging conflict is a part of the conflict unfolding in parallel to the munitions that are detonating and actually causing loss of life. How the war is framed by both sides and indeed in the media space is a really important point, because this is probably one of the most covered conflicts ever. Technology has moved on, so we see, you know, blasts from multiple angles, user footage and everything else. Really important aspect, I think.
That is important. Alexandra, I don't know how closely you're following the state media or the media in Russia. How is this incident being covered there?
I think it's kind of, they were very quick to make the point that it was a Ukrainian missile even before the official statements from NATO and so forth. But they blame Kyiv. I mean, they're drawing all the points, the change in rhetoric from initial assumption that it was Russian missiles triggering Article 4, triggering Article 5, making it really big case, and then saying when it turned out to be Ukrainian missile, the West says like nothing to see here, let's move on, it's all Russia's fault anyway, even if Ukrainians did it. So for them, of course, it's a big propaganda win. There's no question about it, for internal consumption. I don't think it makes a difference internationally, because the NATO support for Ukraine will not be affected by incidents such as this. But domestically, yes, it is a big win for Russia. Mm.
Robert, we mentioned before that the US has announced it's going to open a permanent military base in Poland. That's to boost NATO's defences in those countries that are bordering Ukraine. Is it enough to get that permanent base in Poland to defend from, to deflect an instance like this happening again?
Well, no, I don't think it has any direct impact on that at all. This is the United States showing reinforcement, psychologically as much as anything else, to affected NATO countries. The base might be relevant in terms of helping to maintain equipment that's being used in Ukraine, but it's really basically symbolic. Mm-hmm. But one has to be very careful on both sides about this. It really comes down to another point, which is, at what point does one start working on what's called war termination? At what point has Ukraine demonstrated that Russia will not prevail? And at what point will Mr. Putin be able to claim that he has validated what he called his elementary objectives in his special military operation, which relates to essentially Russian-speaking parts of Ukraine, including Crimea. The important thing now is for wise people to start thinking about how do you try to bring this to a halt in ways that will meet the minimal objectives of both sides. And the answer, at least in part, can be found in a document that already exists. It's called Minsk II.
Minsk II, explain more.
Well, Minsk II said, in effect, was agreed between Russia and Ukraine with the Germans and the French involved, we were not involved, that there should be some form of limited autonomy for the areas in south and southeastern Ukraine that are now under combat and under contention, leaving aside Crimea. Neither Ukraine nor Russia followed through on that agreement, but at least there has been discussion of what could look like an outcome. And ultimately, what you're going to have is the Ukrainians having sovereignty over everything, but that the people in these areas having a chance to live a life in which they can use the Russian language, et cetera, et cetera. But Russian soldiers have to get out of Ukraine. Now, we are already in pre-negotiations. You can hear what the United States says, what Zelensky said, even some things that are being said from the Russian side. One of the questions is, how much damage will continue to be done in Ukraine during this winter? How much damage to the grids that supply heat and light, et cetera, before serious negotiations really get on? It's these attacks against the grids are inclined in part for Putin to establish a more preferential negotiating stance. But we're already in pre-negotiations.
Okay. Samir, what's your response to that? Let's look at the big picture for a moment. The end of the war, how does it come about? Is Minsk II the way to go? I mean, it suggests that Ukraine must be open to negotiations. Robert's saying pre-negotiations are already happening. I mean, Ukraine strenuously denies that, says it is not in a place where it is ready to open any kind of talks with the Russians. What is the Ukrainian position here?
Very quickly on Minsk II. So I worked in the OSCE monitoring mission in support of Minsk II in the first Russian invasion 2014-15. And, you know, I had a ringside seat to how that unfolded. I was in Ukraine, actually, in East Ukraine, in Donbass, when Debaltseve was taken by the separatists. Just at the same time over in Belarus, in Minsk, the agreement was being negotiated. And Ukrainian negotiators back in February 2015, they had their backs against the walls. They had to really make concessions at the negotiating table because Debaltseve was taken, Mariupol was threatened, yada, 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 so on and so forth. Mm-hmm. The difference now, and where I depart from Robert slightly, is the Ukrainians feel that they have the wind in their sails militarily. It's a very different war. It's a much bigger war. And my sort of conclusion, I wrote the book to explore some of the reasons and the ways in which you could actually bring this to an end in the longer term. Sadly, I don't think the Minsk formula is going to work now. Too much blood has been shed. Sadly, I think some form of de facto, if not de jure, partition may actually be the outcome. And just the final point on this, Laura, the analogy I actually draw is, believe it or not, Cyprus. A conflict and a division, which I think has escaped many people's active memories. But there are some diplomatic fudges around what is and isn't sovereign territory and how you deal with a partially successful invasion that has taken some territory and not the rest of it. We're still, I think, a long way away from this, though. I still think pre-negotiations, perhaps, but the Ukrainians are going to want to explore on the battlefield the fullest extent of their deoccupation, potentially, if I can sort of... It's Zelensky-like.
Alexander, just in the last minute we have, Russia's view on Minsk II, whether or not it would accept limited autonomy in areas such as Crimea and Donbass. Is it a way forward?
Well, Minsk never included Crimea, so Crimea was always left out from the negotiations. Minsk II is dead because that's why Russia is invaded, because it's decided that it was never going to be implemented. And it was never going to be implemented because it was simply unpopular, too unpopular in Ukraine to be implemented. Any president trying to implement it, actually implement it, really implement it, would have been facing extremely stiff political resistance within Ukraine. Yes, so the final line, it's just, it will end. We're not anywhere near that of negotiations, but the question is where the final line, the front line, will be when the negotiations actually start, probably in a year, so maybe a couple of years' time.
Okay.
I think that's what always about, you know, facts on the ground, where the dividing line will be. And after that, solution will be found.
That does have to be our final line. Many thanks indeed for joining us, Alexander Titov, Samir Puri and Robert Hunter. And thank you too for watching. You can see the programme again anytime by visiting our website, that's aljazeera.com. And for further discussion, do go to our Facebook page, that's facebook.com/AJInsideStory. You can also join the conversation on Twitter. We are at AJInsideStory. From me, Laura Kyle, and the whole team here,